Chapter 14. The Sparrows. Rudolf Denzler was making a routine inspection of Kaiser Steinbruch POW camp outside Vienna in the summer of 1944 when he learned that a group of inmates in American uniforms had been spotted in the punishment cells. The Swiss official demanded to see the Americans and found that, for all these men had suffered hardship, bad food and continuous humiliations, they were possessed of unshakable morale. There was nothing Denzler relished more than tying up Nazis in red tape. "I immediately informed our embassy in Berlin," he wrote, before firing off a message to General Westhoff, head of the POW division at German High Command, with whom he had a friendly and agreeable relationship. Westhoff ordered that the men be handed over to the Wehrmacht at once. A few weeks later, the three Americans, along with a squad of seven British commandos captured after an abortive parachute landing in Albania, were loaded onto a train for Colditz. "To my great pleasure, I could greet them," wrote Denzler. "Only when these people entered the castle yard, exhausted and neglected, did they become Wehrmacht POWs, and thus protected by the Geneva Convention." The new arrivals were led by a mustachioed figure who strode through the castle gates as if arriving as guest of honour at a Manhattan soiree. A tall, slim, good-looking man with greying hair who looked exactly like a distinguished Englishman, in the words of Douglas Bader. Florimond Joseph du Saussoir Duke was the first American prisoner in Colditz, the second oldest paratrooper in the American Air Force, and one of the least successful secret agents of the Second World War. As the flourish of his name suggests, Duke was a scion of the American upper class, an East Coast WASP from a privileged world that had thrived and prospered as the jazz age boomed and then sidestepped the worst of the Wall Street crash. One branch of the family had founded Pan American Airways. Another owned some of the most valuable real estate in Connecticut. Duke graduated from Dartmouth College, played pro football for a season for the New York Brickley Giants, and caught the end of the First World War in France as an ambulance driver, before taking peacetime employment as the advertising director for Time magazine in New York, a job that involved plenty of socializing and very little effort. Florimond Duke was wealthy, happy, good-looking, and crushingly bored. On the 2nd of September 1939, he sat sipping a cocktail in the garden of his country home, listening to the radio and looking out over the well-tended lawns. It was, he recalled, a golden late summer afternoon in Green's Farms, Connecticut. Germany had just invaded Poland, but life was good for Florimond Duke, with an enviable job, a stylish house, and a handsome family. He was 47 years old and had already played his part in one world conflict. "I could have sat this one out," he reflected, "but things were too quiet for my taste." Florimond Duke put down his martini and headed to war. Duke was too old for the front line, but having pulled every string to get back into the army, he was assigned to the Office of Strategic Services, the fledgling wartime intelligence organization formed to coordinate espionage, sabotage, and subversion behind the lines in Nazi-dominated Europe. The OSS would eventually evolve into the CIA. Lieutenant Colonel Duke was placed in charge of the Balkans desk, an area of the world he had never seen and knew nothing about. The landlocked state of Hungary, hemmed in by borders with Germany, Czechoslovakia, Romania and Yugoslavia, was having a most uncomfortable war. Hungary had been the fourth country to join the Axis powers in June 1941, alongside Germany, Italy and Japan, and Hungarian troops had taken part in the invasion of the Soviet Union. Hungary's oil was vital to the German war effort. But by 1944, the Hungarian government, under its Prime Minister Miklós Károly, had begun reaching out to Britain and the US. A series of top-secret meetings took place in Switzerland, accompanied by a flurry of coded messages exploring how the country might extract itself from the steel embrace of the Nazis without falling under the control of the Soviet Union. Hitler knew exactly what was going on. German counterintelligence agents had bugged the telephones in Bern and broken the American codes. Unknown to either the Hungarians or the Western Allies, the Führer was actively planning to prevent the defection of his disloyal ally by invading and occupying Hungary. In February 1944, the OSS, with no inkling of these invasion plans, worked up a scheme to drop a squad of agents into Hungary to contact the anti-Nazi plotters, discover their bona fides, and generally gather useful intelligence. Florimond Duke immediately volunteered to lead the three-man mission, codenamed Sparrow. "But this is a parachute mission," Duke's boss pointed out, "and you've never jumped." "I can learn," he replied. Duke would be accompanied by a radio operator, Major Alfred Suarez, a tough Hispanic New Yorker who had fought in the Spanish Civil War, and Captain Guy Nunn, a Californian adventure novelist who spoke perfect German and was big enough and handsome enough to play the part of the hero in one of his own yarns. Their orders were somewhat vague. The three agents would drop unseen into Hungary and then help shorten and win the war by liaising with the highest authorities and carrying out negotiations as to how Hungary could leave the German camp. Duke was told that he should on no account agree to a deal. The OSS informed MI6, "Party is not, repeat, not authorized to make or accept peace feelers." The Hungarians, seeking to break away from Hitler, were hoping for a full-scale Allied military intervention to protect their country against the Nazis. What they got was a middle-aged advertising executive armed with thousands of American cigarettes, nylon stockings, and gold for the purposes of bribery. Duke's parachute training lasted an hour and involved jumping out of the side door of a stationary plane parked on a runway in Algiers. In the early hours of the 16th of March, the three American officers were dropped from a British Halifax somewhere near the border with Yugoslavia. Duke nearly castrated himself when his parachute opened with a violent jolt and he discovered the harness straps had slipped too high on his crotch. Amazingly, the men landed without further injury, buried their parachutes, and set off to find some Hungarians who could put them in touch with the government. A message arrived at OSS headquarters in London. Sparrow dropped successfully. That message was also read in Berlin, where preparations for Operation Margareta, the invasion of Hungary, were well advanced. Hitler threw a tantrum when told the Americans had landed. "I always told you that the Hungarians ultimately will try to stab us in the back," he shouted, "and this is what's happening right now." According to Wilhelm Hoetl, SS Chief of Intelligence and Counter-Espionage in Central and Southeast Europe, Duke's arrival set the machinery in motion. The three Americans were picked up by Hungarian soldiers and escorted to Budapest by a cheerful Air Force officer named Kirai, a former bush pilot in Western Canada who spoke perfect North American English. "We've been expecting you for some time," he drawled. They were lodged in a basement room of the Foreign Ministry, fed a sumptuous meal from a nearby restaurant, and politely asked to surrender their Colt 45s. The next morning, Kirai reappeared, looking crestfallen. "At this moment, Hitler is invading Hungary. The Germans will be in Budapest within the hour." He was most apologetic. "You must think we are a bunch of dopes. I swear we didn't dream Hitler would go off the deep end. We must turn you over to the Germans as prisoners of war." Kirai advised them to get rid of any incriminating evidence, including their code books. Survival would depend on convincing the Germans they were not spies, but innocent soldiers who had accidentally parachuted into Hungary while en route to join the Yugoslavian partisans. Finally, they handed over their money belts, containing $6,000 in Louis d'Or gold coins, confident they would never see the money, or Kirai, again. Mission Sparrow had achieved exactly none of its aims. Far from shortening the war, it had helped kickstart the Nazi invasion of Hungary. Kirai tried to cheer them up. "The rumour is that Hitler had to stop you before you got started. 16 German divisions to stop 3 American officers. Not a bad ratio." For 5 terrible months, the Sparrows, as they called themselves, were shunted from one prison to another, in Belgrade, Berlin, Budapest, and Vienna. They were repeatedly interrogated by the Gestapo's accomplished bullies. "We are soldiers," Duke insisted, "not criminals, not political prisoners. I demand that you get us out of here right now and send us to a POW officer's camp." On at least 3 occasions, Duke was told they would all be executed the following day. They tried to keep up their spirits by holding fly-swatting competitions and comparing their nightly tally of bedbug bites. Duke spent his 50th birthday in the basement cells of Gestapo headquarters in Berlin. He lost 35 pounds and grew an elaborate Air Force-style moustache, which he twisted into points. They slept in their flying jackets. Back in Washington, they were listed as missing in action, presumed dead, which is almost certainly what they would have been had Rudolf Denzler not found them languishing in Kaiser Steinbruch POW camp. Florim and Duke might have been a hopeless spy, but he was a natural leader, and the arrival of the first Americans sent hope fluttering around the castle. They added a freshness and a new outlook to our lives. Prisoners locked up since the start of the war had never seen an American soldier in uniform before. With his patrician self-confidence, Duke personified America's manifest destiny, an assurance that the Allies would triumph eventually. The British called him Dukey. "He was intelligent, older, and wiser than we younger men," observed Bader. "A consoling personality." Duke took in good spirit a fair amount of ribbing about his improbable first name, and the Americans were soon woven into the fabric of Colditz society. Checo Kalupka began teaching Al Suarez to speak Czech. Florim and Duke joined the Bridge Club. After the horrific experiences of the last 5 months, he wrote, "Colditz Castle seemed, for a while, like freedom." And yet, for prisoners who awoke every morning in the same dank stone cage, the prospect of freedom itself remained a distant, cruel dream. A febrile atmosphere pervaded the camp, with morale soaring or plummeting on the slightest pretext. One wit suggested that the place should be renamed Hot and Colditz. Formations of Allied bombers flew overhead to pummel the German cities and gleamed in the sun like great, beautiful things. The communist Mickey Byrne, only half joking, declared that if the Soviet army reached the camp before the Americans, he would join its ranks as a commissar. But then, often without obvious reason, as Padre Platt observed, an air of sadness spread over the camp. The eternal optimists had little enthusiasm left for the victory that was always next month and just around the corner. They were nearly played out. Wearied by their own thoughts, the prisoners pried into those of their fellow captives. "People are now at such a loose end that they occupy their time minding other people's business. If one goes and stands looking out of a window for a few minutes, up comes somebody and asks what one is doing." A series of plays in the castle theatre helped to take the prisoners' thoughts off the uncertain future. Drama in Colditz had come a long way since the days when men dressed up in paper tutus and stomped around the stage belting out music hall songs to an ill-tuned piano. The superior productions of 1944 were a far cry from the early days, wrote Platt. Though he disapproved of the homosexual undertones in a production of Noel Coward's Blithe Spirit, declaring it completely amoral. Ever vigilant for sins of the flesh, the padre detected a decrease in moral resistance and an increase in perverted interest. The padre feared that homosexualism was on the rise, and while the majority were making efforts to resist its development, others, unobtrusively, were not. At the same time, religious enthusiasm seemed to be waning. "It is at a low ebb," he wrote. Unlike the early days of captivity, when church service was one of the biggest things in camp life. As the days grew shorter, the prisoners gritted their teeth once more to stand another winter behind the bars. In one case, literally, Mike Sinclair's friends noticed that the stems of his pipes were always quickly bitten through. A similar tension gripped the German garrison. Some of the Wehrmacht officers privately resigned themselves to defeat, while others clung to the hope that Hitler's secret weapons would finally win the war for Germany. "I'll shoot myself and my family," said one die-hard Nazi. "But before that, I'll go into the yard and finish off a few of the prisoners." Eggers had no intention of doing away with himself or anyone else. But even that arch realist tried to force himself to believe the Nazi propaganda, imagining an outcome in which Germany emerged intact, with honour. "We lived in two worlds, of fact and of illusion," he wrote. Eggers had no doubt that when the end came, there would be an accounting. The blood-stained fake uniform worn by Sinclair during the Franz Josef escape attempt had once been a historical souvenir. Now it looked more like a piece of incriminating evidence that could be presented in a post-war trial. Eggers quietly removed the grisly artifact from the Colditz Museum and burnt it. The internal power dynamic of the camp was changing fast in the autumn of 1944, bringing with it a strange new gentleness between some of the guards and the guarded. Eggers borrowed a box of films made by the German Educational Film Society from the town schoolmaster and arranged a Saturday night cinema club in the theatre. The Life of the Cabbage Butterfly was hardly gripping cinema, but it was marginally better than nothing. Prisoners who gave their parole, a promise not to escape, were permitted to go down to the town under guard to play rugby on the village green and bathe in the river. In early September, when an officer was found hiding in a pile of leaves during the park walk, the guards merely hauled him out and walked him back up the path. There was none of the accustomed abuse or threatening to shoot. The vicious goon baiting of the early years abated, and then all but disappeared. Only Douglas Bader kept up the torrent of insults and impertinence. The mockery had once been an expression of defiant resistance. Now, as the bombs cascaded onto Germany and the Soviet and Allied armies grew closer, it seemed like bullying. Reinhold Eggers, so long the target of cruel derision, found that the prisoners had begun to treat him and the other German officers with something that felt almost like kindness. Typically British, they began to feel sympathy for the underdog. On his visits to the castle, Rudolf Denzler noticed that the mutual aggression was dissipating. As the war worsened for the Wehrmacht, fewer incidents took place, and a spirit of comradely consideration developed. The prisoners and their jailers were growing closer. In the wider war, the men who had escaped from Colditz waited, wondered, or fought on as the last chapter opened, the ending unknown. Airy Neave and MI9 had successfully smuggled more than 5,000 British and American soldiers and airmen through the escape lines in occupied Europe and back to Britain. In the immediate aftermath of D-Day, Neave was deployed to France to organise Operation Marathon, a mission to gather hundreds of downed airmen into forest camps where they could be rescued by the advancing Allied armies. Alain Le Ray, the first escaper, had taken over command of French resistance forces in the Vercors, launching sabotage raids against the Nazi occupiers. And by 1944, he was chief of de Gaulle's French Forces of the Interior. Fellow Frenchman Pierre Mairesse Lebrun, the exquisite equestrian who had vaulted over the wire in 1941, joined the Allied landings in Provence in August and was now part of the Liberation Army fighting northwards to the Rhine. Hans Larive, whose discovery of the route into Switzerland had made possible his own escape and so many others, was commanding the Dutch motor torpedo boats, helping to liberate the Netherlands. Jane Walker hunkered down in a small village on the east bank of the Vistula, a redoubtable Scotswoman disguised as a peasant and speaking perfect Polish. The Red Army was approaching, and Mrs. M was not at all sure she wanted to be liberated by communists. Frank Errol Flynn was repatriated via neutral Sweden. Back in Britain, he suffered a mental breakdown and was sent to a hospital near Blackpool. I was unfit for fighting. Life seemed meaningless for a long time. 4 years was a long time in prison, the best years of your life. Recovery was slow. Two notable Colditz escapers who had reached Switzerland were trapped there after the escape route through southern France was closed following the Nazi occupation of Vichy France in November 1942. Their experiences were very different. Pat Reed was serving as assistant military attaché in Bern, secretly working for MI6 and enjoying life as a free man. There he met a young American woman and swiftly married her, news that electrified Colditz when it reached the castle. Pat Reed married an American heiress in Switzerland, Padre Platt reported. The myth of the irrepressible Colditz escaper was already taking shape. Meanwhile, Birendranath Mazumdar was billeted in a hotel in Montreux on Lake Geneva. To begin with, Switzerland felt like paradise. It was a good life, good food, good wine. He went back to work tending to the ailments of the various Allied servicemen who had reached Switzerland, including a number of Indian soldiers. The British had set up a social club, where he played billiards and bridge with a naval petty officer named Hammond. He enrolled for another medical degree at the specialist tuberculosis clinic in Locarno. He even started a love affair with a young Swiss woman named Eliane, whose wealthy parents lived in Baal. Yet an air of suspicion still surrounded the Indian doctor. Soon after arriving in Montreux, he was summoned by Lieutenant Colonel Henry Foote, a tank commander who had won the Victoria Cross in North Africa before being captured and imprisoned in Italy and then escaping to Switzerland. "I cannot say that I took a liking to Mazumdar," Foote reported to London after interviewing the Indian officer, whom he described as needlessly verbose and somewhat cantankerous. The British authorities were deeply distrustful of the doctor's contact with the Indian nationalist leader, Subhas Chandra Bose. In 1943, Hitler had provided Bose with a submarine to take him to Southeast Asia, and the figurehead of Indian independence was now in Japanese-occupied Singapore, recruiting more Indian soldiers for his Army of Liberation and establishing, with Japanese support, the Provisional Government of Free India. MI5 set up a special unit, Section Z, to investigate Indian subversion, and a file was opened on Dr. Mazumdar. During what felt like an interrogation, Mazumdar described his visit to Berlin, pointed out that he had turned down every invitation to collaborate, and then tried to change the subject. Foote duly reported that Mazumdar did not want to talk about Bose and certainly displayed no keenness to do so. This was hardly surprising in the circumstances, but it was enough to mark him out as a potential traitor. Officers who had served in British India, like Foote, regarded Mazumdar with particular mistrust. Some referred to him as a Bengali Babu, a pejorative term for an Indian perceived as overeducated and uppity. At the Montreux Club, it was pointed out that his guest was only a petty officer, and the snooker table was strictly reserved for commissioned officers. The message was clear. They did not want Mazumdar in the club. One afternoon, he was accosted by a British colonel. "Speak to your countrymen," the officer instructed. "Tell them not to socialise with Swiss girls." Once again, Mazumdar knew that the order was aimed directly at him and his relationship with a white woman. "Colonel, I shall not do it," he replied. "As long as British officers socialise with Swiss girls, then I will." "It is an order." "I refuse to obey that order. You're wasting your time. I'm supposed to be free, so don't chain me. You can't chain me." Lieutenant Colonel Sidney Lavender of the 16th Punjab Regiment was the senior British officer in Switzerland. He had won a DSO in North Africa and escaped from an Italian prisoner of war camp. Having spent most of his adult life in British India, Lavender was convinced he understood the Indian mind, and he did not like what he thought he saw in Mazumdar's. Late in 1944, he spotted an opportunity to bring the Indian doctor down a peg. Many of the escaped prisoners were suffering from eye conditions, and to establish a better diagnosis, Mazumdar decided he needed an ophthalmoscope, an expensive handheld magnifying tool with a light to see inside the eye. He ordered one from Geneva, obtained a chit from the senior medical officer, and bought it with petty cash. A day later, he was summoned to see Colonel Lavender. "You're a bloody liar, Mazumdar," the colonel bellowed. "I beg your pardon," said Mazumdar. "I'm not used to that kind of language, Colonel." With a torrent of expletives, the senior officer accused Mazumdar of theft, claiming he had embezzled the money intended for the purchase of the ophthalmoscope. Mazumdar later discovered that the girl who sold him the instrument had been wined and dined and persuaded to sign a statement that she had not sold him the ophthalmoscope. "You didn't buy it." Mazumdar pointed out that he could produce the brand new instrument as proof. But Colonel Lavender had by now launched into a furious diatribe about Indian corruption and the reasons why that country would never be ready for independence. "I disagreed with everything he said," Mazumdar recalled. Both men were now on their feet, shouting. Lavender went from pink to purple. Finally, Mazumdar exploded. "The difference between you and me, Colonel, is this. You have lived in my country for 25 years and you can't speak one of its languages. I have lived in your country for 15 and speak five languages, including yours." Mazumdar was placed under house arrest in a Locarno hotel to await court-martial on a charge of stealing. "I had nobody to help me," he wrote. A prisoner of war for 4 years, the Indian doctor had escaped only to find himself a prisoner once more, but now in British custody. If and when Mazumdar finally made it back to Britain, MI5 would be waiting for him. By the autumn, celebrity prisoners were arriving in Colditz in numbers that seemed increasingly ominous. October saw the appearance, under heavy guard, of a small, self-effacing New Zealand sheep farmer named Charles Upham. He was so shy and the atmosphere in the camp so jittery that some immediately assumed he must be another spy. In reality, he was the only combat soldier to have won the Victoria Cross twice for outstanding bravery, in Crete and then Egypt. Riddled with bullets, he was captured during the First Battle of El Alamein and refused to have his arm amputated, despite the urging of Italian military doctors. After numerous escape attempts, he was taken to Colditz, where he flatly refused to discuss his heroics. He preferred talking about sheep. Another new arrival, equally brave but a lot more talkative, was David Stirling, the founder of the SAS. Under his quixotic command, the fledgling Special Forces unit had caused mayhem during the North African campaign by slipping onto the Axis airfields at night, planting bombs on the parked German and Italian aircraft, and then disappearing back into the Libyan desert as they exploded. Nicknamed the Phantom Major by an admiring Field Marshal Rommel, Stirling was finally captured in January 1943. He tried to escape five times, from camps in Italy, Austria and Czechoslovakia, before being shipped to Colditz, where his reputation for extreme waywardness preceded him. David is regarded with the gravest suspicion by the prison staff, a fellow prisoner wrote. They daren't leave him alone for a minute. The distinguished ranks of the Prominente were also swelled by the arrival of a stream of blue-blooded prisoners plucked from other camps. The first to join Giles Romilly and Michael Alexander in elite semi-isolation was the Earl of Hopetoun, son of the Marquess of Linlithgow, Viceroy of India between 1936 and 1943. Captain Charlie Hopetoun of the 51st Highland Division had been captured at Dunkirk and now found himself in Colditz for no other reason than because he was his father's son. They were joined by two nephews of King George VI. Lieutenant Viscount George Lascelles, sixth in line to the throne at the time of his birth, who would become seventh Earl of Harewood, and Captain John Elphinston, later 17th Lord Elphinston. The Nazis had always been obsessed by the British royal family, and these royal captives were blandly informed that they were being protected. Of equal propaganda value was Captain George Alexander Eugene Douglas Haig, 2nd Earl Haig, the son of the late Field Marshal Haig, Britain's most celebrated First World War soldier. Doric Haig was a pallid, depressive artist who wore silence like a dark cloak and suffered from amoebic dysentery. According to Michael Alexander, captivity had affected him more severely than the other Prominente, and he seldom spoke, finding painting more expressive than speech. Haig had been president of the Bullingdon at Oxford, and Hopetoun had been a member. The new arrivals were immediately inducted into the camp's most exclusive club. The addition of Max de Hamel, Churchill's distant cousin, brought the contingent of Prominente to seven. They dined together, shared rooms, and were securely locked up by 7:30 p.m. They were no longer allowed to take walks in the countryside. Evidence that the Germans were corralling valued prisoners into Colditz reached London, and this disquieting development was immediately relayed to Downing Street and Buckingham Palace. The King thought it rather sinister that the Germans should have collected in one offlag all these young men who are near relatives of prominent people in this country, Sir Alan Tommy Lascelles, the King's private secretary and a cousin of the new Colditz inmate, wrote to Churchill. These sudden transfers have an unpleasant significance. The Prime Minister briefly considered trying to exchange the Prominente for senior German prisoners in British hands, or launching a commando raid to seize them, but it was decided that special action on behalf of individual prisoners would only serve to emphasise to the Germans our particular interest in them. Instead, a formal request was sent to the Swiss protecting power to monitor the welfare of the special prisoners. At the same time, a pamphlet was drawn up by the Political Intelligence Department of the Foreign Office to be dropped on POW camps, containing a solemn warning that the Gestapo, commandants, prison officers and guards would be held individually responsible for the safety and welfare of Allied prisoners of war in their charge. That might make the ordinary camp administrators pause before resorting to murder, but it was unlikely to have much effect on Himmler and his SS killers. Rudolf Denzler knew that his power to intervene on behalf of the Prominente was limited. POWs are hostages in the hands of a warring nation, and Colditz contained especially valuable ones, he wrote. Sir James Grigg, the Secretary of State for War, warned Churchill, "The high-ups in Germany are keeping the Prominente with the intention of trading them against their own skins later on. Our people are in no danger until we get some of the main war criminals into our hands, but it would mean a terrible dilemma for us later on." The Prominente were now unwilling guests in what David Stirling called the Third Reich's most closely guarded hostelry, with no idea whether they had been herded together to be kept safe, swapped, or slaughtered. The Romanovs had also been gathered together in 1917 before they were massacred. When Hopeton asked why he had been moved to Colditz, the response was chilling. "We do not wish to happen to you what happened to the Russian royal family."